Accession number 20515, Reel 3.
Brindley, Reel 3.
Yes, Helinski, he made his wife do everything for him and the girl. He said she was quite sure that if he could have an extension to his leave, she could get things sorted out. Well, we arranged for somebody in the edge to go and visit them. And they found there that Helinski and his wife were perfectly happy together. The whole thing was a fabrication.
In order to get leave?
In order to get leave, yes, extra leave. Well, he arranged for him to see a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist reported that the real problem was that Helinski wanted to be a driver. If only he could be a driver, everything would be solved. Well, now, drivers are very jealous of their vehicles. They don't like other people using them. And the only one that we could make available was the water cart. Well, Helinski went onto the water cart, and the water cart is easy enough to drive when the tank is full or when it's empty. When it's half full, if you go around a corner, the water starts swinging in the tank. And one morning, the family were having breakfast in the living room, and suddenly, crash, there was a water cart in the front room with them, and no driver. Well, we got in touch with us, and we arranged to have a temporary repair done to the house, and presumably the whole thing patched up again. But we didn't see Helinski again. I don't know what happened to him. But there were others too. There was Danny Vandenberg, who was a professional boxer, and he was Jewish, and he was hopeless with money. He was always getting into trouble, and he used to come to me to sort out his all his money affairs and get it right. And he was Jewish, so much for stereotypes. Freddie Rand and I shared a batman, and this was Gunner Bates, and his profession was put down on his record as purveyor of horse flesh. And I immediately thought, oh, something to do with racing. And then I realised that he was, in fact, a cat's meat man. He used to go round houses selling horse flesh for cats. Well, the regiment was put on to training for mobile warfare. And we spent a lot of time in East Anglia doing this. I was the troop leader. The arrangement was we'd be given a target, or a target area, and the troop commander would go ahead to recce the area. And when he got near to it, he would select a suitable place to be a report centre. And he would leave someone there to direct the troop when it arrived. Now, my job as troop leader was to lead the troop to the new report centre. And of course, in those days, all identification for places was removed. All place names, all signposts were taken down. And so you had to find your way across the country without any help from signs using a quarter-inch ordnance survey map. And it does require constant vigilance. You've got to keep looking at the country side around and keep looking at the map and reconciling the two of them. And I was, I was very good at that. I think I'm the only officer in my troop, in my battery, who didn't actually lose his way at least once. My driver was Gunner Gordon, and he was a Scotsman who had ran a farm in Scotland, and it was part of my job to censor the letters of the men. And I know that in his letters he used to write to his sister. He used to give her instructions on what to do with the farm. And in fact, he was running the farm while he was still in the army through these letters. And one occasion, we were just about to set off in the front. I was in a utility van. He would drive it, and I would be standing up. We had the top down. and with my map. And we were just about to set off, and he said, "Sir, sir, I've got to go." I said, "Well, you can't do it now. We're just going off. We're taking the troop off." So we set off, and a bit later, my utility van suddenly went across the road, and then back again, and up on a bank. And I looked down, and Gunner Gordon had a bottle, and he was trying to relieve himself into it. Well, I did manage to stop the column shortly afterwards, much to his relief. I mean, that was Gunner Gordon. We did a lot of this, only in East Anglia. And then, this would be 1944. And this was when the war began to come back to us, because we went down to the coast of Devon, and the troops there were getting ready for the D-Day invasion. A lot of American troops there. And that's right. We were put an operation then. We went actually first of all to a place near Gloucester, and I had to go down. I went down with some tractors to collect some new guns, and we went down, and we stopped at it overnight at again, it was a castle, at least that was the name of it, it was a house actually, where there were other troops also stopping for the night. And I remember that one of them was, what's his name, the Yorkshire cricketer, Maurice Leyland, that's right, he was a major. Now, other ranks wore battle dress buttoned up to the neck. Officers had theirs open, and they had collars and ties underneath. But Major Leyland didn't. He also had a battle dress buttoned up to the neck. And when somebody mentioned it to him, he said, "If it's good enough for my men, it's good enough for me." And anyway, we went down to Manorbier and collected the four guns. And we're on the driving back, and it was dark now, and the quickest way back, we found, was through Bristol. And unfortunately, well, I chose that way, and it was the wrong way, of course, because it getting through Bristol in the dark with a quarter-inch map is no good. And I had to stop and ask somebody the way. I was fortunate there, because it was, in fact, a bus driver. And he got in the cab with me, and he drove us and guided us through Bristol. And we got through without any problems at all. So that was very lucky there. And we went back to Gloucester with our new guns. And then we went down onto the south coast. Now, I'm not terribly clear about this, because we were then given what we hadn't had before, some predictors. We'd call them predictors in the heavy ACAC, for putting in height and range and so on, and deciding where the gun should point. These were American, and they didn't call them predictors, they call them computers. So I had a computer in 1944, but it's not what we mean now about it, it's by a computer. Then, yes, I remember the day that the D-Day landings took place, and listening to it on the hearing on the radio, "We have now landed in France." And of course, just after that, the flying bombs, the V1s, started to come over, and we were suddenly deployed to shoot at those. Now, in theory, a flying bomb like that is an ideal target, the anti-aircraft. It flies at a constant speed, at a constant height, in a constant direction. And it also, for night time, has a little light, or quite a bright light on it, for you to aim at. So we shouldn't have had any difficulty in shooting down every one of them. But it wasn't quite like that, because they were not all that accurate. They would change course sometimes, or change height. And of course, you could hear them, and if the engine cut out, you knew then that the V1 was going to come down and explode. And another one of the chance fortunes of mine. There was an attack one night, and we were going out to our gun sites, and Lieutenant Voisey was me, and he said, which site are you going to? I said, I don't know. He said, all right, I'll go to number one site, you go to number two. So I went to number two site, and shortly afterwards there's a telephone in the site, rang, and it was a sergeant from number one site. He said, Lieutenant Voisey has been killed, sir. And a flying bomb had come down. And I would imagine that it was flying debris, fragments from the bomb that killed him. Anyway, he was killed by this flying bomb. And if I'd said, no, I'll go to number one, it could have been me.
So, where were your guns located?
Well, I'm trying to think. They were somewhere along the south coast. We kept moving, because as the D-Day landings came on, so the flying bombs moved to the east along the coast. So we started off in Devonshire and moved along, and eventually we were in Sussex, stopping every now and again and setting up, because we were a mobile unit, and this is what we were doing.
Do you think you actually hit an AV wand?
I don't know. No, I don't think so. Certainly not that I can recall now. No.
So how useful were these American computers?
I don't know. I'm sorry, I'm not clear at all this at all. I'm trying to remember having recorded some hits, and I don't remember doing so I don't know.
It's probably on documentary record.
Quite possibly, yes. And again, I'm not clear how the computers that the Americans provided us with were actually operating with our guns, because on the flying bombs we were using them on open sites. You had this light going. The gunners could, the one for angle, one for elevation, and one for bearing. They turned the handles and used their sights to get onto the target. Yes, that's right. They would be used to calculate, I think, speed and layoff. Because obviously you didn't fire at the target; you had to fire in front of it if you wanted the shell to hit it. Anyway, we were going along the south coast once, and this time the colonel was going in front on a recce, and I was leading the rest of the battery. And the colonel set on a report center and went off, and then I came on with the troops, and eventually we got to the report center, and there was nobody there. Now, it's absolutely essential to keep contact between the different parts of a unit, and the report center is the way in which the troop following on keeps contact with the commander who's gone ahead to do the recce, and there was nobody there. So I stopped the troop and sent off a dispatch rider to see what he could find. And eventually he came back and said, oh yes, I found them, sir. He said, the colonel decided to change the report centre. Well, I was furious. I went back, and the dispatch showed me where the new report centre was, and I went back to it. And the colonel was there, and I said, "You bloody fool! Don't you know you must never change the report centre? That's how we keep in touch with each other." He didn't say a word. But a couple of days later, I got a message saying that I report to RHQ. "Sorry, Brindley, but we've been asked to supply an officer for posting overseas. So I'm afraid you will have to go." It's interesting, jumping ahead a bit now. When the whole of the war was over and I was coming back, I met two of the sergeants from that battery. And I asked them what happened. And they said, "Oh, well, we went over, went into France and on into Germany." So, but the colonel didn't go with us. He was replaced before we left England. So I felt then, well, perhaps there was some justice done somewhere. Anyway, I was told that I would have 7 days embarkation leave, and then I had to report to Woolwich, which I did, and I found there that we were we were going to India, and when I got there, I had written on the voyage, I'd written down an account of this, which I typed out somewhere, and I still have it. But I'll try and remember the main parts of that here. That we weren't sure where we'd be going, but we went, I think, to King's Cross. We were taken there. We're all officers, and it's surprising how often I kept meeting chaps that I'd known before in the army. One was Lionel Lethbridge, and I'd been at school with him, and he was an officer in the Dogras. And Toby Toynbee, that I was at Octu with, I met him again when I was in India. And Phil Jones, that I'd been at Octu with, and he was on this with me now. I met him at the Woolwich when we were all setting up, going off. We went off, I think, to King's Cross, and then we were put on a train, and we went to Glasgow. And I could say that I'd set foot in Scotland then, because we went off the train onto a boat, which was the Batory. It was a Polish boat that had been built for the North Atlantic run. And we found that it was... Well, actually, this would be... this was December 1944. And this was going out to India, and it had on it civilians and officers. There were no other ranks, soldiers being in the transport. It was officers and civilians. And I was told afterwards by Jim Teasdale, who was also on the boat, and I became very friendly with, I'm still in contact with him, that the first part was in a convoy in which was taking the Duke of Gloucester to Australia, where he was going to be Governor General. Now, that anyway, we went off in the convoy. I know we went out, well out into the Atlantic, and went round. Because, of course, the Germans were still operating U-boats from France then. And eventually came to Gibraltar, went through into the Mediterranean. I think the Duke of Gloucester's convoy left us then, and we went on through the Mediterranean. And eventually, on my birthday, January the 12th, 1945, we landed in India. Now, some of the troops on board went straight off to the 14th Army. This was at Kalyan Transit Camp near Bombay, and I was there for a week, maybe 2 weeks, before being posted. And it was there that I, when we wanted to write home, we found that the best thing to use was the airgraph. That was a quarter sheet of paper, and which we could write our letter, our message. It was then photographed on microfilm, and so a lot of them could be sent back in one view towards the United Kingdom, where they were then enlarged again to a quarter of the original size. And I tried an experiment, and it seemed to go very well, of doing some sketches, drawing cartoons, if you like, on these aircrafts. Generally speaking, I'm making fun of our situation there. And I still have these that my wife saved when they came back to her. Eventually I was posted. Again, I'm not too sure of all the places here. I have got a record of them written down somewhere. I was posted to the... oh dear, was it the 16th? Laitayak Indian Regiment, Indian Artillery. And the troops we had were Madrasi troops. And I was actually quite pleasantly surprised as to perhaps I too got tied up with stereotypes, to find that the Indian gunners and the drivers and the tiffies and so on were excellent in their work. And they were Madrasis, and a lot of them, as I found later, had come from quite remote villages where they had really no contact with the modern equipment and so on. But these gunners and artificers and drivers were excellent. So you want to stop?
Where was this unit that you were posted to?
Well, it was just north of Calcutta. Actually, we thought it was near Calcutta, and it looks it on the map, but it's actually about 70 miles away. But we had a long train journey there, and one of the things that rather amused us was some brass notices that were screwed to the door of the train compartment that we were in, which forbade British soldiers from looking out of the window without wearing a topi. And they were not allowed to go out without topis and spine pads, which were a sort of felt pad that went down the back to protect it from the sun. Well, when we got to Callian, actually, I said it was in January, and most of the Indians there were wrapped up white and were shivering because it was so cold. For us, it was a wonderful summer's day, beautiful and warm, and we were having showers outside in the open. Quite different. Anyway, we're on the train going to Calcutta, and I went to this Indian unit, and one of the things I remember there was the bananas growing on a tree near us, and I remember picking a green banana, thinking, I wonder what this is like. It was dreadful. It dried up the whole of my mouth. For about an hour I had fur all inside of my mouth trying to eat a green banana, so never again. But there were plenty of ripe bananas there, just growing on the tree to be picked. Very good. We did wonder, actually, when we were ever actually going to take part in the war. And then we had a message. I say we, there were me and a few other officers who had come out with me, that we were to be posted to a unit in the 14th Army. And we thought, thank goodness, at last we can we'll be seeing some action. Actually, I was quite pleased when we first got there to find that our pay did include what they called JCP, Japanese Campaign Pay, which made us feel that we really were part of the war. And now we were actually going to be part of the 14th Army. Well, we're waiting for this to come, and then we were told, right, the unit you're going to has just come out of Burma, and they're here in India. So we went to them, and we were part of the 14th Army, but not in Burma. The colonel there was, well, he was awful, and I don't mean he filled us with awe. He had us, all the new officers up in front of him, and he ranted on us in front of the troops. All the gunners were there as well, because we hadn't been in Burma, because we hadn't been out long enough, because we hadn't done anything. And he went on like this, and he did everything he could to put us down in front of the gunners. Well, as it happens, it was Jim Teasdale who was there with me, and he said that he spoke to some of the gunners afterwards, and they told him that, and it did help us a bit, that they thought nothing of the colonel. They thought he was terrible, because when they had been out in Burma, the guns had been posted forward, and he had been back, and he was supposed to go. Jim said actually that he got the DSO, was it? Yeah, for going out to his troops who were in the front line there. But the troops said that he went out there, he got into a slit trench, stayed there for the whole of the time, and then went back. I don't know, but anyway, we all thought that he was quite out of order in doing what he did, but he did it. And then that unit did go back to England. We did hear, actually, from somebody else, that the colonel had died before they left India. He was a Canadian.
But this was an Indian Army unit, was it? Or a British Army unit?
This was a British Army unit, I'm sorry. This is, yeah. They were all British troops, all white troops. Now, it was, while I was with this unit, I was posted, I was sent on a course to Karachi. Now, that was another very long train journey. And I enjoyed that journey, because we went to Amritsar, and I saw Zamzama, the big gun that Kim, in Kipling's story, sat on as a boy, and then down to Karachi, through the Sindh Desert. And there I was on a course on mobile warfare. Now, as it happens, I knew a lot more about mobile warfare from my training in England than the officer did who was running the course. Mind you, I don't know if what I'd done about mobile warfare in England would have been any help in Burma. But anyway, the chap who was running the course was quite happy to sit back and let me give some of the lectures. And it was while I was there that I heard on the radio that the Allies had dropped another an even bigger bomb on Japan. And I thought, well, every time we hear this, it's a bigger bomb, and it's a bigger bomb, and nothing seems to happen from it. Well, I was very wrong, wasn't I? Because that was the atomic bomb. And very soon after that, the war against Japan finished. Now, again, it's fitting it into the time scheme that I'm not too sure about now. But, yes, it would be before Christmas, that's right, that the unit was repatriated, and we stayed behind and were then transferred to another Indian artillery unit. And
can I just get this clear, because about what you've said about the units you're in India, because you said at first that you were posted to a unit manned by madrasas.
Yes, that's right.
So that presumably was an Indian Army unit. Yes. But then
that was the Royal Indian Artillery, that was, yes.
When you had the Canadian CO, the other ranks were English, weren't
they? Yes, yes.
So that was a different...